I hope that you will have another set of very impressive presentation. Thank you.
Thanks for the kind introduction, and thank you for the very kind invitation to come here and speak to you. So what Marty just talked about is actually the best introduction possible for the talk that I'm going to give, and I hope I'll make some of the connections or putative connections are clear between these Bayesian inference ideas and more mechanistic ways of how such learning might go on in the brain. When we look at the brain, we see a lot of organization, a lot of structure at multiple levels. We all know famous results by David von Essen's lab about cortical areas and how they're connected. We know the wiring at this sort of macroscopic level. At the mesoscopic scale, we know a lot about the organization of, say, representations in primary visual cortex, pinwheel maps, orientation columns, and so forth. But at this microcircuit level that is depicted here, we're still grappling to understand what the connectivity is and what the function is. And that is sort of one of the big challenges in neuroscience to make this kind of relationship between structure and function at this microcircuit level and how these networks give rise to interesting computations. Now, of course, we're making progress. And at this microcircuit level, there are various ideas out there in terms of computational ideas about canonical microcircuits and what they might be doing. We're getting better and better statistical descriptions of what the connection probabilities between layer 2, 3 pyramidal cells and, I don't know, layer 5 pyramidal cells are, this kind of stuff. But this is still a far cry from having something like a detailed wiring diagram, the kind of work that Moritz Helmstetter is trying to approach with Denk and colleagues. And in principle, not knowing what this circuit structure looked like, we might look for two possible sort of caricature hypotheses here. One is that these networks might essentially be at this very local scale more or less random, right? Of course, we know about cortical columns, but how exactly you're connecting to what of your neighbors, right? It could be more or less a random structure. And that is maybe not total nonsense, because we know from this reservoir computing field that even random networks have very interesting computational properties, right? Many of you have heard about things like liquid state machines and echo state networks, and there's sort of a growing literature in machine learning also and in computational neuroscience of what you can do with these randomly structured networks and how they have interesting computational properties, actually somewhat related to the kernel ideas that that Bernhard is famous for. And the alternative view, of course, is that these little microcircuits are highly, highly organized. And one good reason to believe this is we know that structural network changes, like where a little synaptic spine is forming, where a synapse is being created, we know that these structural changes are associated with learning. And there's a nice recent review here by Caroni from this year that I would recommend. So, but how would this kind of structure come about? And here I think we're well advised to view this from this perspective of network self-organization. Of course, a given network structure of units with synaptic connections between them implies a certain kind of dynamics in the circuit and ultimately gives rise to certain computations, right? So, and we may ask, what kind of network structure do you need to have something like, say, a Bayesian inference process going on in such a network, right? Which is one question that many people are asking. But at the same time, the dynamics of such a network will always feed back onto the network structure via plasticity mechanisms. And so there's this feedback loop going on between structure determining dynamics, dynamics, on the other hand, determining structure or influencing, modifying structure. And what this is probably going on all the time in our brain, and it will go somewhere. And it's a really, really tough problem. But we have to try to figure out what this is doing, where this is going, and how it can produce any sort of useful circuits with useful computational properties. Now, of course, there's a vast array of plasticity mechanisms in the brain, and you all know about them. And they occur at very different timescales. We have neurogenesis, we have structural plasticity, intrinsic plasticity, we have things like spike timing dependent plasticity, we have things on different timescales, as I said, lots of different things, some homeostatic mechanisms, some more associative mechanisms. We know they're all operating in the network, and this raises a number of important questions, of course. How do they interact? How do they shape neural circuits during development and adult life? And how do they shape neural codes? Because this will also ultimately influence or determine how information is encoded, represented, and transmitted from one part of the brain to another. And a couple of years ago, we got interested in these questions and started looking at sort of very simple single neuron models, putting different forms of plasticity in there, seeing what they can do. More recently with Christina, who was just there on the previous slide by Mate, we looked at how things like independent component analysis can be implemented or learned by networks of spiking neurons by a combination of different plasticity mechanisms. And what I'm going to talk about today is about recurrent networks that combine a number of different plasticity mechanisms that we are just treating as very interesting dynamical systems, and where we also try to relate this to computational ideas. And of course, you have to start simple, right? You can't just try to put everything in there at the same time and hope that anything useful comes out or that you understand anything. So we're trying to develop this in a way, step by step. And we've decided, and this is joint work with Gordon Pieper and Andrea Lazar, to start with three plasticity mechanisms. Spike timing dependent plasticity, which was already mentioned many times here at this conference, with intrinsic plasticity, which is not as widespread in computational neuroscience. This is basically the ability of neurons to change their own excitability based on the modification of voltage-gated channels. It's been found pretty much wherever one has looked. And frequently, this is observed as changes in the frequency current curve of neurons. So here's a plot from a 1999 experiment. You inject a current into a neuron and look at with what rate the neuron is generating spikes. And now you can activity the deprive the neuron by applying a sodium channel blocker, which will prevent the neuron from spiking for, say, 12 hours or so. And then you see that afterwards, after you've cleaned up the preparation, the frequency current relationship has changed quite a bit. And the neuron is now much more excitable. That is, for the same current you inject, it will generate many more spikes. Right? And these kinds of mechanisms, they occur on different timescales and very often seem to have some homeostatic function trying to regulate the activity of the single neuron. And this is how we're going to use them as well. And finally, here's another kind of homeostatic mechanism, synaptic scaling, that is very well studied. Similar idea, also in a homeostatic fashion here. All the incoming synapses of a neuron might get up or down regulated in a proportional fashion in order to maintain some total activity level of the neuron. So we want to study how they interact, put them together in a network. And this is, as I said, work with Andrea Lazar. She's now a postdoc at the Max Planck Institute. And Gordon Pieper, who is now a professor at the Cognitive Science Department in Osnabrück. And these networks, what do they look like? Well, they have excitatory cells and inhibitory cells in a 4-to-1 ratio. And we can feed input time series into these networks. So we have among the excitatory cells a couple of special populations that receive external inputs. And if we want, then we can also train a linear readout, a linear classifier on various kinds of tasks related to these input series, right? So the most generic thing would be to try to predict what the next input element is going to be. So what does this look like? We have to choose a level of abstraction at which to formulate these models. And we decided to start with something very simple and classic, like these recurrent networks of essentially threshold units that were already studied by many people, but very famously also by van Vreeswijk and Sobolinski, where the state of each neuron is just given by applying a threshold function here to a weighted sum of inputs. From that, we subtract the inhibition in the network, so a weighted sum of the activity of the inhibitory units. Some of those units will get an external input sometimes. And then there's an adaptive threshold that every unit has and that it can regulate to maintain its mean activity level. And for the inhibitory units, it's even simpler, right? They just sum some of the excitatory activity here, and they even have fixed thresholds that are non-adaptive. So this is extremely simple, but it becomes very complex and really very hard to understand once you plug in these plasticity mechanisms. And of course, we need to sort of define somewhat abstracted versions of these plasticity mechanisms suitable for these simple binary threshold model neurons. So we are using a binarized STDP, which changes the connection between unit I and J in this sort of causal fashion. So if I spikes before J, then the connection from I to J will be increased. If the order is reversed, it will be decreased. In all other cases, it's left alone. And I should say the connectivity in these networks is sparse, like 10% or so. So these are not fully connected networks, but they have sparse connectivity. And so right, the intrinsic plasticity mechanism is also very simple. You basically, whenever you're spiking, you're sort of increasing your threshold a little bit. When you're not spiking, you're decreasing your threshold a little bit in order to maintain some stable activity value, HIP, which is sort of the target firing rate, which in this case we set the same for all the neurons. And the synaptic scaling also, right, you get the idea, we're trying to keep everything as simple as possible. It's just the normalization of the weight vector, such as all the weights here will always, all the incoming weights to a neuron will always sum up to one. So very simple, but due to this interaction of dynamics with plasticity, due to this sort of self-organization going on, this will show very interesting and intricate complex behavior. So what are we going to do? First little test drive. We're using a network of probably 100 units here in this example. And some of those will receive inputs here. And we're feeding random sequences of these letters into the network. And we let the network self-organize and adapt the weights and thresholds. And after some while, we look at the activity of the unit. And you see, OK, this looks exactly like the brain. Random, messy spike trains. So obviously, we must be on the right track here with this. Let's do something interesting. First thing to do is, what happens if you switch off these homeostatic plasticity mechanisms? And what you see is, well, very quickly, the network under these conditions will develop fairly pathologic activity patterns. For example, if you switch off the synaptic normalization, the network will have a very strong tendency to synchronize and create these very synchronous bursts of activity. If you switch off the intrinsic plasticity, it'll get into some funny dynamic regime where some neurons never spike and others are spiking almost all the time. And of course, this is not desirable. And in these kinds of states, the network will also not be able to do any interesting information processing, as you might guess. So let's look at some interesting tasks. And we've looked at quite a few tasks by now, but my favorite is still this little counting task here. Still a very simple task, but let me guide you through this. we're basically feeding two, what you might call words, into these networks, which is an A followed by a repetition of N Bs, and then a C, or the other word, that's an E, followed by N repetitions of D, and then an F. And we're going to sort of randomly alternate these two words. And that's all what the network is ever going to see. Right? So very, very simple. And of course, why is this a counting task? Well, if in the end you ask the network to predict what the next letter is going to be, then in order to do this properly, it will have to essentially learn to count along how many Bs have I already seen or how many Ds have I already seen. So it needs sort of to count along or have some memory of this sort of these previous inputs. And what we're going to do is we're going to train them in two phases. One is the unsupervised phase, where you just present these input sequences to the network, and it's doing its thing with the different plasticity mechanisms and the STDP, and it's learning some internal representation. And then after that, we can, but we don't have to, with a supervised method, train a linear classifier here to make the prediction of what is going to come next. Okay? So let's first look at this unsupervised part. And the question is, you know, how will the network learn to represent these input sequences? And what is the benefit of having these plasticity mechanisms in there? And here's a comparison showing what these plasticity mechanisms will actually do. So what I'm plotting here on the left-hand side is the activity of the network for different input conditions projected into the first three principal components. Okay, so you have a very high-dimensional network state, as many as you dimensions as you have units. We're projecting it with PCA on a lower dimensional, three-dimensional space in this example. And we're comparing here the random networks, random reservoirs, which don't have these plasticity mechanisms, but are otherwise tuned to perform optimally by being brought close to criticality. And comparing that here with the networks, the SORN networks, the self-organizing recurrent networks, which have a chance to learn about the input sequences via these plasticity mechanisms. And what you see here, while this is sort of a big and ugly mush, the network will, with the plasticity mechanisms, learn to map different input conditions, like the fifth and the fourth and the sixth repetition of this letter D, onto very distinct internal network states. And there's a little animation that shows you how this unfolds over training. This is, I believe, over 10,000 training time steps. And you see how these different input conditions, so fifth or sixth repetition of a letter, get mapped onto very different internal states of the network. And of course, that is what that might be very useful for such a system to be able to do this. So, so this is just purely unsupervised by virtue of having the STDP combined with these homeostatic mechanisms in this network. Now we can sort of go ahead and train a linear readout to say, make a one-step prediction, what letter is going to come next, okay? So still very simple. And these are basically the results. The way I'm presenting this here is we're looking at networks of different size, from 100 excitatory units to 800 excitatory units. And we're asking for the SORN networks or for the random reservoirs, how long can I make the sequence? So this, how often do I repeat these middle letters and still reach a performance that's better than 95%? And you see, for a given network size, the recurrent networks with the learning ability, they will be able to handle much larger problems than the static reservoirs, which are, as I said, still optimized to work on the edge of chaos in the critical regime, where they have been shown to function best, and that's also what we find empirically. So if you basically think of these random networks as sort of liquid computing, as liquid reservoirs, then what these self-organizing networks are, they're superfluids. This was supposed to be funny, but well, never mind. Okay, let me tie into what Marty was talking about. So there's, he already mentioned many of these things. Spontaneous activity, we see that in the cortex with different techniques. You can visualize with optical imaging also, for example. We do know that following repetitive presentation of a visual stimulus, the spontaneous activity, even in V1, shows similarity to the evoked responses. That's a paper from Yang Dan's lab in Berkeley. And this equation, or a very similar one, Marty had already on his slide. So spontaneous activity might represent something like a prior or samples from prior in the Bayesian inference sense. So we were very excited about these new computational ideas, and that motivated us to look at the spontaneous activity in the network. So after it has learned something about some input sequences, you can just switch off the input, and due to the homeostatic mechanism, it will sort of generate activity on its own. And here's one example of that, where you see that this is, again, this view in the PCA space, comparing the evoked activity, those are the little colored circles and letters here, with the blue traces, which are spontaneous activity. And you see that a property of these networks is that in their spontaneous activity, they will basically trace the kind of evoked activity that they've seen previously. So, right, this is all very mechanistic here, but in a sense, you can interpret this certainly as the network having learned some internal model, to pick up on Marty's language, and now sort of you see samples from that internal model. Now, there's more to this, especially we can now go ahead and do a very simple modification. We can say, show some of these, one of these sequences here, two times more often than the other. So the blue one, we show two times more often than the red one. And now we look at the spontaneous activity, right? These will all be little points in this high dimensional space. And for every point in this spontaneous activity, we can ask, well, does it fall close to a point in the state space where there was evoked activity for the one sequence or the other? So basically, we're checking how often is the spontaneous activity close to the evoked activity, okay? And this for the two sequences. And basically, what we're seeing here is when one sequence was shown twice as often, then the spontaneous activity in the network will also roughly twice as often be close to the evoked activity for this more prevalent sequence. And if you say make it three times more prevalent, then the spontaneous activity will also sort of tend to visit this part of the state space correspondingly more often. And this is sort of average over all the different states in such a sequence. And this is sort of the version here per individual state in the sequence. So very simple networks, very simple tasks, if you like, but some kind of intriguing relations here of how these networks get structured and the kinds of dynamics that they show. Now, if there's something to it, then in principle, one should also be able to find some sort of traces of Bayesian inference-like computations in these networks. So how would we go and test that? Well, what you do in these inference tasks, well, you always combine some sensory evidence with your sort of learned model. You always combine the likelihood term with the prior and use that to calculate a posterior. Okay? So what we're doing here is the following. We're going to put it in this situation where it's going to get an ambiguous input, and we'll have to combine that with some learned prior to tell us, and then tell us what it thinks. So how does this work? We're going to have these two input words And one we show 75% of the time, and the other 25% of the time, okay? And again, right, they sort of alternate randomly. It's all very simple. And we train a readout to predict what the next letter should be, an M or an N. And now during testing, so after it has sort of learned this, we're gonna show funny sort of mixtures of A's and B's. So where sort of 80% of the A population gets activated and 20% of the B population or something like that. So we're gonna show it ambiguous stimuli that it has never seen before and that it has no experience with. And we're gonna ask, well, how is it going to interpret this and how is it going to sort of activate these readouts? What is the, in this sense, sort of posterior that it's estimating this way? And to visualize this here, we're basically plotting the output drive here for these different mixture ratios between A and B. So if you have 80% A, then you can be relatively sure that an X should come, and in the other case, I believe it was a B. But now, what the network does, and that's the neat thing here, it's also taking into account the prior probability of these two sequences. So what you should compare here are the solid dark lines, the prediction of N and the prediction of M. Those were the letters. And you can compare that here to what the sort of ideal observer would be doing. And of course, right, with a small network, this is not a perfect fit here, but there's sort of a strong hint that at least qualitatively, this network is doing the right thing, taking into account both the uncertainty in the stimulus and the prior model of, you know, what stimulus is how likely to occur a priori, and combining this somehow in its recurrent dynamic in the right way to produce a sensible output. So these are very simple networks, of course. I think I've mentioned the word simple now a dozen times or so. You should stop me from doing this. But so for me, at least, they're quite intriguing. But of course, it's very important, right, to ask, does this have anything to do with what we can find in the brain? So we're trying to make progress on this on two ends. On the one hand, we're using these networks to also model human psychophysics data on sequence learning. And I won't have time to get into that, but I'll point you to a poster later. And the other is we're trying to explain some aspects of the structure of neural circuits with these networks. And again, there's a poster that you should check out to learn more about the details. And what are we interested in? The things we're trying to explain here are twofold. The pattern of synaptic connection strength, which have these log normal-like distributions, which we have already heard about today, which you can get from paired recordings of individual neurons, but also the pattern of fluctuations of synaptic weights, or in this case, spine volumes, that people observe in the developing rodent cortex here. So these days, right, you can do imaging of dendritic spines over extended periods of days or weeks or even months, and you can see them, you know, fluctuating in size, disappearing, appearing, getting smaller and bigger. And here are data from Yasumatsu et al. From 2008, where you see that if you look at the change of a dendritic spine over one day, you get a certain distribution. There are some that have newly appeared, they fall on this y-axis here, there are some that disappear, and overall there's just a ton of fluctuation, right? Synapses appear and disappear all the time in large quantities, of course raising a question of how we have stable long-term memories and things like that. So these are some of the data we want to explain, and for that we extend our network by just getting rid of the input, getting rid of any output, making the units a little noisy, putting in the structural plasticity to model this process of growth of new synaptic connections, and also putting in an inhibitory STDP rule Somewhat similar to what Tim Fogels talked about. I'll just skip the details here. And when you do this to these networks, so they have no input, they're just sort of doing their own thing, developing their internal structure, and you look at them and follow their organization for a while, you see that they generate these sort of Poisson-like looking spike trains with exponential ISI distributions and CVs that cluster around one. You see low correlations, at least in the sort of initial phases of the organization of the network. And if you compare the weight distributions to experimental data, it looks actually very nice. So we also see this emergence of log normal-like weight distributions in these networks. And this is independent of the starting distribution of the synaptic weights in the network, whether it's uniform or Gaussian or exponential or just a delta peak. So this seems to be something intrinsic to this organization process in the network. And if you follow individual weights, they seem to undergo some random walk-like process. If you look at the lifetimes, you see that there's a power law with a slope of minus 3/2, so suggestive of a random walk process. And if we look at the pattern of fluctuations of these weights, again, it's sort of very close to experimental data. So here we have relative changes over a day and absolute changes over a day, and all these main features, so this very simple model nicely reproduces. So how does this work? So here's a hint at how it works. I don't have much time left, but the basic story here is, if you look at the fractions of weights, fraction of connections that increase their strength due to STDP in one time step, you see that this is a growing function with synaptic weights. So bigger synapses have a higher chance of getting potentiated. And that makes intuitive sense, right? So if you already have a strong connection from A to B, then a pairing A and then B is more likely, and this will sort of foster this growth process of these synapses. And basically, what is going on here is a rich get richer mechanism that stronger weights have a higher chance to grow, and this ultimately leads to these log normal distributions. I have to cut this short. And again, these sort of the absolute fluctuations that you see here as a function of weight strength, that is sort of a reasonable, at least qualitative fit to data that was recently published by Löwenstein et al. So I'm not gonna say much about this motor sequence learning tasks, but so on the other end of the spectrum, we're trying to connect it to psychophysical results. There's a poster there, and what is nice is there's in these sequence learning tasks, there's a complex pattern of facilitation and interference effects if you learn multiple tasks that are sort of similar or structurally similar. And there are effects of training structure, whether you train, right, all the blocks, the different sequences in a blocked fashion or in an interleaved fashion. And we have some very nice explanations for how this works and why this works. So I sort of invite you to check out the poster. So let me just skip over this and just come to a summary here. I talked a lot about these self-organizing recurrent networks with different plasticity mechanisms. They have this neat feature that they learn useful, interesting internal representations. There's a hint that they may be related or can be interpreted as performing Bayesian inference and Bayesian learning like computations. And we admit that this is not, you know, fully worked out and understood, but so we have empirical evidence at this point that this is what they're trying to do. And we can connect them to physiological data, both at the microscopic level in terms of distribution of synaptic strengths and their patterns of fluctuations, and also now to the psychophysics level of actual people learning different motor sequence and different tasks. So I think these are sort of a very interesting area to study. And with that, I'd like to thank the many people who have been working on these things over the last couple of years and played with them. And I'd like to thank you for your kind attention. Thank you. Can you wave real quick so I can see you? Ah, yeah, okay, got you.
So when you present, what's the actual activity measure that you're using? Is it, so you present a symbol over an interval of time and then look at the rates over that time interval?
Well, no, this is actually running in discrete time steps. So a symbol will be sort of one or several time steps in a row. And, right, the activity, everything proceeds in discrete time steps.
Okay.
So these are then just vectors, the activity in some right, high-dimensional space,
and
you then, just apply a PCA.
Okay, and then am I right then in interpreting that what happens at this is that the network learns some kind of limit cycle in that space that is the sequence, the sort of sequence through
well,
those
it,
points?
It can, of course, it can learn different things depending on the inputs that you feed into these networks,
yeah.
Right? So if you just give it a single limit cycle, then it will sort of learn that limit cycle.
Yeah.
But it can learn all sorts of things. So
but
we have done lots of experiments, and it tries to capture the statistical structure of these inputs.
But somehow I thought you were focusing on the idea that the points are somehow separated, and that was important, or maybe I misunderstood.
Sure. Initially, before the unsupervised learning part, right, it will just be a random network, and it will not be particularly good at mapping different inputs onto distinct internal states. But due to the plasticity operating in the network, it manages sort of to nicely separate and tease apart different inputs. Right, it's trying to make as much use of its phase space as it can and sort of arranges different input conditions into this phase space.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for the very nice presentation. You've shown in the first part that if you leave away one of the three learning rules, your network becomes pathological. Now, in the last part, you add the structural plasticity. Can you now leave away one of the others?
No, there's a bit of a redundancy between the intrinsic plasticity and the inhibitory STDP. The way we formulated it, they have sort of a similar functional goal of maintaining a certain average activity level for each neuron. So in principle, the network will work without one of them, but then it will only work in a sort of fairly narrow parameter regime. If you put them both in there, the network is extremely robust. You can sort of mess with the learning rates and the connectivity, and you will always find very similar results. Speaking of robustness, right, these are very simple threshold units. We also are working on a version with more, well, realistic leaky integrated fire neurons, where essentially we can reproduce many of these effects here. I think there's also some of that on the poster. So it's really a process of self-organization rather than due to a sort of specific choices we have made and with these very abstract model neurons or plasticity mechanisms would be my guess.
Okay. Before the very important announcement, I'd like to thank the speakers.